coming out with new medications and new treatments that are keeping up with the rate that they're losing old medications that are going off patent protection. So it's actually to their best interest to try to seed more early stage research, and they can always come in and pick up research at a later stage and buy the rights, develop the actual proprietary compounds later on anyway. So we think there is a way to shift pharma to more of an open source model for certain cases, obviously not all their data. The other place where we're trying to build a data repository is off academic data sets. And there you also have the case where the large academic hospital organizations that gather these types of data sets want to hold on to the data and get as many publications as they can off the data set so that they can write the grants and bring in the funding, right? And their behavior is actually even probably tougher to change than the big pharmaceutical companies, because they're so tightly wedded to this model of generate the data, write the paper, write the grants, get the funding, generate the next set of data, right? And so really what we're trying to do is shift reward structures such that those people can find other ways of funding that more directly benefit the patients by pooling data and then opening up a way to do meta-analysis on all that data. Discovery platform is what I'm going to spend the rest of this talk talking about, so I'm not going to touch on it here in the intro. And then the commons pilots is just the notion that you can't do these sorts of things in isolation. You have to put the software platform, the data sets, the science all together into concrete projects that have concrete deliverables with defined groups of people and actually try to execute them. And we're trying to run a number of pilots. Sage itself is relatively small. We have on the order of 30 people total. My software technology team is 7 people. We have maybe 20 people on the science side, so it's pretty small, and we're trying to actually form these pilots that are collaborations between us and a mix of academic and industry partners in order to show that this way of doing a more open science actually leads to better results than one lab is going to do it all, or one company is going to do it all by themselves. Okay. So what specifically are we trying to build? We're really trying to build the analytical framework for understanding how do you model disease. And then when I say models of disease, I mean statistical models of disease, not mechanism bottoms-up models. So we're trying to build an environment where that kind of starts with data curation and goes through what are the whole set of complicated analyses that are done to multiple layers of information to actually come out with a prediction that gene X or protein Y is a biomarker or could be used in this disease in this way, right? And then go off and do the experiment. So it's kind of the scope of it, starts with data curation, getting all the data in the same spot, and kind of ends with the prediction. We're not trying to capture the experimental wet lab processes that have to go on outside the system. All right, so I'm going to kind of step through some of the main themes of the software platform, and then I'm going to take you through kind of more detailed demo of the system that's under development. So one of the main themes is this notion that if you want to understand what's happening in a complex analysis, you have to watch and capture what people are doing as they're actually doing it. So the current model is you get the data, you have some analyst load the data on their personal computer or on their personal folder of a cluster, and they do some work on it, and they plug away for 6 months, and at the end of 6 months they write the summary of what they think they did, right? And then they said that's what they send to the journal article. And if you ever actually read a journal article that's got some description of a analytical methodology, you're usually pretty hard pressed to actually go back and reproduce that result and validate it. But more importantly, if you can't do that, you can't do the next step, which is what you really want to do, and that's take this analysis that was done in study X and apply it and modify it and then use some of the same ideas in study Y. It's very difficult to do right now. Even if the authors send in supplementary material and data to the journals, just the fact that they're pulling that together 6 months after they actually did the analysis when the paper's going in, you lose too much. So we think that the way analysis should be done is more like the way that software projects run or other engineering projects run, where you're actually tracking the evolution of the analysis in real time. And when you get to the point where you're writing the paper, you kind of hit the snapshot button and say, this is the state of the project when I wrote the paper. I can get back to that, and hopefully this online environment is your supplementary material to the journal article that you will eventually write. But it's built, the key part is it's got to be built up in real time. The second main theme is kind of this notion of if you're able to capture the workflow as it goes on, you're actually able to enable people to publish intermediate artifacts for other people to build off. So you can actually open up these analyses to multiple teams of people working in series or forking off of each other's work. You can put the data into a state where multiple people can try different things to it, and then you can have evolution on the actual scientific process itself, where multiple people can try different things, and then the best methodology will eventually win out over time because you're actually working off the same data or using the same, using multiple analysis methods, applying them to the same data set and saying which one's actually giving me the best, the most bang for my buck, right? The third main theme here is kind of trying to embed aspects of social networking and that type of technology into the environment itself. So again, this is building on the theme that these analyses are becoming so complicated that there's no one person that can do it all. You have to be able to work with your teammates to get a project done. And in the long term, in order to build your career, you have to be able to find new people that you can work with in new ways that you never thought of when you were starting the project. And then the final main theme of this work is kind of leveraging the aspects of cloud computing. So as these data sets get really large, it's becoming increasingly infeasible to ship the data around to multiple partners who are working on the same data. The rise of cloud computing technologies is allowing people to put the data into one spot, give multiple people access to the same data, and have people upload their analysis to the data rather than move the data around to multiple different computer environments. I'm highlighting Amazon here because we have a particularly good relationship with Amazon. Everything that I'm going to show you is built on top of Amazon Web Services as a basic infrastructure platform. We're trying to be somewhat agnostic and leave the door open to go to other cloud environments in the future, because it'd be very hard for me to predict if Amazon is still going to be the category leader in 5 years' time, or if a Google or a Microsoft or somebody we haven't heard of yet will pass them. But right now, Amazon seemed to be both the clear leader, and they were also conveniently located 3 blocks from us. We happened to be at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center for our offices, so it was a really good opportunity for us to collaborate. Right. So at a high level, we're trying to enable this robust, reproducible analysis of mixed clinical genomic data sets. And I think that's enough of a high-level summary that I will now flip over and show you the actual running software. And just to be clear about what I'm showing you, this is, I would call this kind of borderline between early alpha and kind of an internal development release of the software. This is not fully functional, but we've mocked up more than is actually functional right now because I want to be able to go out and present what we're doing and get feedback on it before we've actually built it. But just so some of this will be, some of this is real and you can kind of poke around with it. Some of it is mocked up, and we are at the stage of putting the software in the hands of our own internal users, our own immediate partners, and trying to, you know, make sure that we build something generally useful. The ultimate vision is that this sort of thing would be available as a public resource that anybody could use, regardless of whether or not they had any sort of affiliation with Sage Bio Networks. But it's not at that level of maturity right now.
That's a good question.
Yes.
So typically the analysis is, especially in large data sets, is pretty messy. You sort of go in a bunch of different directions, a lot of different deep events. You sort of go back and forth, and what you end up publishing is a sort of sanitized version of all that, right? It's
correct.
Kind of the final analysis that work give you something. So given that this is capturing analysis in real time, all these data events are being captured. What do you see as being the value of that, and how does that affect how people work and what they're willing to share?
Right. So I think there's a couple answers to that problem. That's definitely a real problem, is that it's not the case where people have, you know, the analysis methodology itself is a subject of research and is constantly changing, and the technologies for generating data are constantly changing. So that problem's not going to go away. So one level of answer to that is we're not actually embedding a record of absolutely everything you do during the course of analysis in the software. It's more of a model of the way that a version control system works in software, where you check things out of the system, you do things to the, you do things, if you hit a dead end and you know immediately this doesn't work, you can throw it away, right? So you choose when to check things in and out of the system. So that provides one level of filtering out kind of these extreme, you know, all these inevitable dead ends and experiments. But it's kind of the point where, okay, I did a little bit of work. I think I did something reasonable. I want to check it into the system so that my teammates can at least see what I did. All right, so that's one level of filtering out some noise. The second level of filtering out noise is something that you'll see a high level of view of what we're talking about capturing workflows here. It doesn't have any sort of filtering out of dead ends, but we've heard from many of our prospective users that that's important too. So there needs to be ways in the software itself to kind of mark paths as being deprecated, or this is the active path, or these are experimental side branches, and there has to be a way to kind of use filtering and being able to have a record of things that happened but that went nowhere, and have that present if you need to get to it because you need to dig it back out later, but not dominate the first impression of somebody coming in to say, what does this say to this project? That has, there has to be a way to highlight the things that you think worked and that actually eventually led up to the paper. So that's a really good point.
I assume there will be kind of control for which allow you to decide what is visible to other people outside of your team.
Yeah, so the basic model is that you have these projects that you can form that kind of create a boundary around who can see what's happening in the scope of research. And that projects can include data sets, that can include tools or analysis methodologies, or just little code scripts, and they can include formal networks or models of diseases, right? And so really the model is kind of a GitHub, any of the kind of the code sharing platforms, right? Where you can start a project, you determine who's on your project, you can make the project visible to the public if you want to. That's not something you have to do. But you basically, the basic rule of the software system is that if you're the owner of the project, then you can control who has access to the project. And then as a matter of policy for the Sage BioNetworks team, we only engage in research where the results can be made public eventually, is kind of the way we've had to frame things. So we have a number of projects where we're working with pharmaceutical companies as collaborators, and if we said a record of what we're doing with you is in the public domain as we're actually doing the research, we would get no partners, and we would have no ability to actually do science that pushed a drug further down the pipeline. But we have been successful in saying if our scientists are going to work on the project, there's an embargo period of maybe a year after the project's done, in which you have sole access to the research that we did in partnership with you. And after that, we're going to hit the public switch. And eventually, we want right now those projects are kind of running ad hoc. We're in the process of moving those projects onto Synapse, so there really literally is a public button, right? And a year after the project's done with Sage and an AstraZeneca or a Merck or somebody like that, we're going to hit the public button and everyone can see it. And then the pharma knows that when they do a deal with us, and that's actually, to their mind, they're going to get enough of a head start on the primary goal of the research, and they're really interested to see what else do people do in this area after we make the research public, because they don't have the resources to follow every possible interesting line of research. They would rather, do the things that are close to being a drug, run the clinical trials. That's what they're good at. The early stage research, they'd rather watch a community of people working on the data and pick the winners later on. Question?
So, there's like the PDB, right, where you publish a paper and they say you need to put this structure up.
Yes.
So this kind of reminds me of that. I guess what I'm wondering is that drug design is often there's so much money and there's so much, the drugs are often so close to each other, there's so much secrecy there, that I guess what I'm wondering is, how are you going to get the big players who are really close to doing something, as opposed to people who are kind of fussing around and interesting, but are still 6 years away from actually making
moves? Yeah, so it's important to remember that the pharmaceutical industry has, over the course of the last 20 years, the rate of new drug production has gone down. And is lower than it was 20 years ago, despite all the genomics technology. And that, and every drug that they make, they've got a patent life, where you know they may be able to play games and get extensions or to change the formulation, but ultimately all the medications they produce are going to go off patent and they're going to be replaced by generics and they're going to lose all the revenue. So they have to, the business model requires them to innovate in order to keep putting stuff out there. And it's a tough thing to do, right? Because the lawyers and the business people are like actively shrinking the size of these companies. That's why you see so many mergers in the space. And they're trying they're taking two companies and smashing them together, and then they take the drugs out of both and get the workforce down to the size of the one of the original companies. But that can only go so far, and they know that they need to do more innovative research, and in particular the early stage research that from the idea that investigating a particular drug or therapy, a particular target may be of interest. That first 5 to 10 years, there's an enormous duplication of effort across these companies, and they're you can actually make an economic argument that they're better off collaborating on projects with each other at the early stages, seeing if something works, doing it once as a team, and then they still have the ability to build the proprietary specific drug molecule after they do kind of the proof of concept of something. And that's something that we're working to put together. It's something that Stephen Friend, who's the founder of Sage, was also the founder of Rosetta Informatics, was one of the big biotechs here in Seattle. It got bought by Merck. He ran all of oncology for Merck. So he's got some of the contacts there to make the arguments. And then there's some people in pharma who realize that this is a way out of their problem, but it's by no means a sure thing that it's really going to be able to work. Question?
I'd like you to comment on how in a drug design project the information comes from data about individual health, which is captured in records of individual health, that identifies health condition and other attributes. To what extent are you using well-defined data and common conventions, i.e. terminologies and other sorts of things, for measurement, observation names, and that sort of thing, from individual health records that can then be abstracted and sent by standard messages to analytical databases?
Yeah, so I think we'll see some of this as we go through here, but to answer the question, the approach that we're taking has been to first try to aggregate the data and start making it minimally useful, and then add the semantics over time, rather than saying we have to define the format ahead of time and then convince everyone to match this format. Because if you take that approach, and there's an organization very much like Sage called Critical Path, which took that approach, developed a standard called CDISC, and then said we will be the neutral third party that hosts clinical data from the pharmaceutical industry, just give it to us in CDISC format, and then we can build this database off of it and share. And basically, pharma told them just refuse to do it, right? So we're taking the approach of get the data any way we can. It's hard enough to get data out of drug companies. It's hard enough to get data out of research, individual research labs, without imposing on the people who produce the data that the data needs some sort of format. So we have a team of people in-house that are actually working to take the data however we get it and then try to make it conform to a reasonable standard and develop the standards over time. The other thing that we're trying to do is develop the tooling to make that curation process easier. So the ultimate goal would be that you actually allow the researchers who are going to eventually use the data to actually do the curation kind of by outsourcing or crowdsourcing the data curation itself to make the data conform to the ontologies and the standards over time, right? So it's kind of a Wikipedia model where you start with something that's kind of sloppily put together, and then you build tools and you try to convince people that, well, you're going to have to, if you personally are going to have to put some piece of the data together in order to do your analysis, do it using this tool, and then the results are saved and other people can build off of it.
Thank you. Well, the reason I ask your question is because that's been a common criticism over the past 20 years about abstraction of data for research purposes. Individual health data abstracted for population health analysis. And that was what led to a substantive body of conventions for exchanging data, messaging, which the federal government put a lot of money into. And the attributes are common and really have major contributions from the health information management specialties that have been involved in both manual and automated data. And the big issue is what is the extent to which the drug industry and industry in general is going to look at these conventions and develop common tools so that you don't have to reinvent them, because the criticism has been that all these different variants have all been special and individual in many ways, and many people reinvest money over and over and over about the same basic capability. And so when you're talking about a common tool set, what one would be interested in is the extent to which you're trying to build on what's now known about common conventions related to concepts that will come out of individual health records that must be used in population health analysis. And
so there's a couple. I want to get through the actual demo, but there's a couple different ways that you can approach building a software system. One way is kind of like spec everything out up front, define all the data formats up front, and then make sure everything coming into the system conforms with that set of standards. And that's an approach taken by CA Big, for example, which was literally $100 million government project to build this common infrastructure that has now lost its funding and has no traction in industry, because they tried to predefine everything up front, all the data formats, and they never actually built anything that worked. So we're trying to take the other kind of a lot of newer software development methodologies, kind of the more agile approach of build something that does something simple for a few people, get it to work, and then start modifying your records of the data to start matching those standards when they exist over time, but not, so I mean, we're definitely aware of those standards, and we definitely try to match them when we can. We're trying to build tools that allow us initially and eventually the community to take data that's sloppy and start mapping it to standard forms, but we're also not saying we have to get that right before we do anything else. Because there's several very prominent examples of that approach failing. So I wanted to actually get into the kind of the meat of the demo and actually show you some of the software instead of just talk about it. So the basic idea is I could come in here, and these data sets, tools, networks. So data sets is show me all the data sets that have been collected that are being served out for the public to use in a new project. So there's some simple annotations of the data set where I can say, well, I care about really any studies that are greater than 100 individuals that are done in human and done in prostate, for example, right? Maybe I care about prostate cancer, and I'm going to pull in this data set from Charles Sawyers. So here's a clinical study. The basic structure here is you've got this data set, which is a set of different experimental measurements on the same set of individuals in a clinical study. We have some set of key value type annotations that we're applying to the data. Right now they're completely unstructured annotations, and what we're in the process of building right now are ways to map some of these annotations to ontologies and controlled vocabularies and start kind of making this semantically more meaningful and making sure that certain annotations get standardized across all the data sets that we have. Then here is this notion of data set layers. So these are all the specific measurements that have been done on this study. So for example, if I wanted to see the curated phenotypes, this is basically the clinical data in the study. And if I scroll through here, I can get a sense of what's in here. It's basically some high-level demographic information, Gleason score, which is a biomarker relevant in prostate cancer, some information on treatment, some information on response to the various treatment. And in this particular case, you basically have a control arm and a drug arm here. So I can basically get a preview of the data. If I were to actually log in, I'd be able to to access the data and edit it. Edit the annotations and the structure of the data. So see here, now that I've logged in, it knows that I can download the data. If I want to get at it, I've already downloaded it. But basically one of the bits of things that we have to work on is kind of tracking what are the terms of use, what were the consents that the patients were signed off on when the data was collected, and that determines what researchers can actually do with the data. We have to make sure that researchers are aware of those consents. So there's a whole legal, ethical dimension to this that I'm kind of going to gloss over for the purposes of this audience. What I wanted to get into was kind of this notion of phenotype editors. So we have this idea of building a mapping tool that will let you basically start structuring the columns of this clinical data set and mapping it to standards, for example. So we might say that this AGH column, I'm not really sure what this is. I'm not familiar with the study very well, but so this column might contain only yeses and nos, and this expression array might have these particular values, and these are kind of ad hoc ways to define the format of the data. But more interestingly, we might define some of these columns as being maps to a formal ontology system. So the lesion column, whatever that is we're pulling out of the NCI Metathesaurus this controlled set of terminology, this set of terms that is permissible in that column. And if you start doing this across multiple data sets, you start having a hope of actually combining those data sets and having the same term mean the same thing across multiple studies. So the basic idea is if you want to do a meta-analysis of a set of studies, you want to normalize each data set to a set of standards rather than try to normalize them all to each other, right? So it becomes an N problem instead of an N by N problem. and then creating the mapping, this is where we're trying to look at what did CDISC do, what are the existing commonly used clinical variable names and term definitions that we can map to. Let's see. I want to get into...
Why is that? Seems now to call that a phenotype editor.
Well, so we were trying in this is kind of a terminology thing. Let's see. So basically the focus is really clinical data, but early on one of our first sources of data was a set of preclinical studies ran by Merck on bunch of different mouse populations, and they had phenotypes and clinical and a bunch of molecular stuff as well, and so there is some non-human data in here. And we got in this big debate, clinical data kind of implies that it's coming from humans in a clinical study. And really, those clinical variables are just phenotypes more generally. You could have phenotypes from preclinical, and we wouldn't want to preclude that, even though it's not the main focus of the platform. So it's kind of a little bit awkward, but that's where it comes from. Question?
So you're asking researchers to trust other people's data sets? Is that right?
Well, we're trying to, partially, yes. I mean, one of the things I want to show next is that we actually want to show the processing of that data in a way that's transparent, so you can decide for yourself what was done to that data, and do I want to take the raw data, or do I want to take some statistically processed form of the data and use that because I like the way it was done.
And do you plan to have any kind of rating system, like we really trust this researcher versus...
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of talked about that, like kind of the star rating system, and we kind of feel like that's, obviously people do that on e-commerce sites and stuff like that, but we kind of felt like the number of people on the site is going to be much lower, and then their level of engagement on these studies is going to be much higher. They're going to be looking at the data for a variety of uses, and so we wanted kind of some sort of commenting and commentary, links to discussion forums embedded in. We have, you know, we haven't completely rejected the idea of a star rating, but we kind of feel like that's, you know, for what people are doing on this site, they're doing something, you know, that's much richer than going on Amazon and saying I like this book or I didn't like this book. I'm going to give it 2 stars, right? I don't think you can boil research down to this guy is a 3-star researcher. So I don't know. We might experiment with something like that, but right now it's not a high priority. The conversations and events kind of thing directly on the data is one way to kind of get that contextual information. Is this good? The other way is I guess you have to trust that the instrument and the experimental procedure was valid. That's obviously a source of error. But given that, one of the ideas here is who is actually using this data to do something real? So here I can see that there's 3 different projects doing maybe 5 different discrete analyses to this particular data set. If I grab one of these projects, I've got this predictive modeling project. It's run by Adam Margolin at Sage. So I can see who's on the project. I can get kind of the overview and some annotations on the project. And again, you may have some commentary, and you may have some links out to a document management system to kind of get the contextual information. What is this project doing? But what we want to track is, you know, what is the analysis of this data? So if I click here, what we want to build is, you know, here are the, you know, here's Adam starting with that cancer data set. He's starting with the SNPs and the copy number. He's doing some sort of genetic preprocessing to the data. He's doing some different sort of normalization to the expression data. And he's pulling in the phenotypes or the clinical data, and he's building this data aggregation step. But what he's basically doing is building a big matrix of molecular features versus number of samples, right? And then the third dimension would be for a few phenotypes of interest. And then what this is doing is feeding into this big machine learning framework, where he basically splits that data into a training set, a validation set, fits a model to the training set, and then does this performance assessment, which is how good does the model actually predict the validation set after I fit it. And this is necessary because these things are severely under-constrained, and you can always overfit the data here and build a model that with umpteen different variables that exactly predicts this data and doesn't predict anything else. So you kind of have to build in these penalty functions on the number of parameters that you're using to fit the data. And really, this is an area of active research, right? What is the functional form and methodology, statistical methodology, but to run these machine learning problems and predict phenotype based on a very large number of biological variables, most of which are just pure noise, right? And a few of which are actually informative. But the basic idea here is now, I can drill into Adam's project. I can get a high-level sense of his research, or if I want to know, if I actually want to, do I trust this expression data? Well, I can drill in, and I can actually get the input, the expression normalization step. Here's the input. It's a link back out to that public expression data set. Here's the output. It's just a normalized expression. It's another table of numbers that's normalized, and here's the R script that got me from the raw data to the normalized data. Right. So now I can actually look at his R script. I can look at the documentation that Brigg, his postdoc, uploaded for this step, and I can decide for myself if this statistical treatment here is appropriate for my study and this data and the study was public. I could grab the normalized expression instead of the raw data. But if I didn't think it was appropriate, I might just grab the raw data and do my own analysis. Question.
I just had a question. This flow diagram that you have here, that's basically a record, or are those like active components that we're sort of dealing with some kind of?
This is a record that we're building up after the fact. So the basic, and it's important to know, so this whole system is constructed as a multi-tier enterprise, enterprise system where there's a discrete web client, and the only thing the web client is trying to do is kind of describe the state of your research project with your teammates. Then there's a set of web services that basically are tracking the annotations on data sets, projects, the relationships, and the steps in the workflow. And you can access those web services via another set of clients. And we expect that people actually doing analysis are going to connect to these web services using other clients. And
that's my question about the Taverna, too.
Taverna is an idea, but we actually have done for real. So Taverna is a workflow tool that kind of helps you string together these things. That's one of the several workflow systems that we're looking at potentially integrating with in the future. But in the short term, really instead of a rerunnable workflow, we really want to enable the ad hoc analysis of data use case more than the pipeline industrial pipeline that churns and churns and churns over and over. So the first thing we integrated with was the R environment and the Bioconductor framework. So you can actually log into Synapse directly from your R client, from the command line, right? This could be an actual command line, or I prefer RStudio as my ID. But the basic idea here is I can actually go through, and I'm not sure if the script actually still works or if the service is chained out. Services changed out from under me before I updated my client, so this is not going to actually run and do anything interesting. But you can kind of see here what I'm doing is, you know, you can create a project, create a data set, you can pull a data set out of a public project, do something to it from the command line in R programmatically, and then post it back to your own project, right? And then we think from that we can actually draw the workflow step. If you check in the intermediate result and check in your analysis script, right, we can build the set of steps that happen in your project. Right, so we're not trying to say we're going to build a cute GUI that lets you drive this particular analysis or that particular analysis, because those never keep up with the pace of scientific innovation. The people who are really doing the analysis are all down here using scripting languages and stuff to process their data. So you have to interface with those people in the way that they're currently doing their work. They're not going to migrate the way they do their work. So but really what they have to do is something just very simple, right? The only thing they have to change is that instead of loading their data off the file system by saying load file and giving, you know, the path to load the file system, they say load data from, and instead you give a URL that's a pointer to the thing in Sage, and then we have the client that makes the REST service call and makes the data available for them to run. And if you get them used to doing that, you can kind of get them to post their work back into the system. The other thing that you can do is now become, it doesn't matter where they're actually running their job. This R environment, this could be running on my laptop if it's a small data set, or I could just have this could be an EC2 instance, this could be a MapReduce job, right? You can start using all these different cloud techniques or parallelization techniques, and your client could be running in some sort of distributed compute environment. And we're trying to make that transition easy for our users as well. That's a question.
I'd like to ask you the extent to which you're using standard reference vocabulary such as SNOMED CT and LOINC. Those are LOINC's observation names and values, whereas SNOMED CT is a complete ontology, a large ontology. It's still evolving, and I'm just curious the extent to which you're using.
Okay, so I'm not familiar with LOINC. I'll have to look into that one. We are using some of the SNOMED terms, and we're essentially looking at several different ontologies. We have a partnership with the NCBO out of Stanford, which is one of the main developers of the underlying infrastructure for dealing with controlled vocabularies and ontologies. So I think it's really... you know, just to put this in context, the entire project here that you're seeing is right about a year old, and that's the time I was hired to figuring out the project and hiring the software people. So it's an early stage project, and I don't think we yet have a definitive list of here are all the annotations and how all the annotations that we have map to particular ontologies, but we're in the process of working on that mapping, and we're actually interested in people who can provide guidance in that area as well. Are there other questions? We're coming close to 50 minutes. I think this is the main, this covers, I guess, the most important things that I wanted to show in terms of a talk. Any other questions?
I guess I'll just ask one more, which is how can I hit this data when I use R?
So right now, the way you can get the data is, there's the web UI from which you could just download it and work with it outside the system. There's a set of web services. We have a Python client that we've built. It's not quite as rich as the R1. And then we hope that over time we'll have additional analysis environments integrated with Synapse web services, and whatever tools you're using should be able to, if they can pull data out, access any programming language that can make an HTTP call, you can pull the data out, and then you need to be able to push some record of what you did back into the system. And that kind of depends on the tool. So one thing, in the extreme case, your tool might be Microsoft Excel, and there's no record of what you did. But you could, using our web services, pull the data out of Synapse, do something to it in Excel, push the modified data back into Synapse, and check in a comment that says, I did blah, blah, blah to the data, right? And that would be as good as we could do for that case. Or you may have a richer tool with that actually, captures some sort of record, rerunnable script of what you did, and then you would check that script back in so that somebody else could do the same thing to the data or really understand exactly what you did. So we're not creating a system where there's absolutely, an ironclad guarantee that we will capture every single detail of the analytical process, because in order to do that, we would have to build a system that you could never, we would be responsible for integrating every third-party tool and making sure it behaved appropriately, and you could never move the data out of the environment, and then that would be so constraining that nobody would use it. So we're trying to just provide the hooks where people have a place to check in that record of what they did, and then there's some responsibility on the analyst to try to keep a good record of what they did. Yes?
Yeah, sure. You said earlier that you were going to gloss over this, but I'm going to ask anyway. I'm kind of amazed that you're able to look at clinical data in this manner. So there's been a lot of success with linked data from the sort of bioexperimentation world, which is not linked to patients, right? Because that's much easier to get at and share. And so I'm surprised that you haven't run into major roadblocks. You mentioned you ran into some things around ethical, legal use of the data, and about anonymization.
Yeah. So it's important to know all the clinical data that's going into the system is anonymous and is de-identified data according to HIPAA. So that's right. Part of the answer was to do the kind of research we're trying to do, we don't need the details of the hospital stay and all, and the person's address and zip code, right? You don't need their date of birth. You can strip out all that sort of really obvious ways to easily identify the subjects in the study.
That runs into some trouble.
It does, right? And the biggest trouble we have is around the genetic data, because if you have more than 7 SNPs, you have a pretty good shot of identifying the person. If you have some other record that maps that those SNPs to a person. We're doing several things in parallel. So one of the things that, we're trying to put as much data out as we can under cases where it conforms to the consents. We are, I didn't show any of this right now because it's not built yet. We're in the process of kind of building a tiered access system where if you need access to certain types of data that's more sensitive, then you need to, as a researcher, you need to supply your institutional affiliation, you need to supply your IRB number. We're trying to make it not as onerous as dbGaP, but we still need to, we're still trying to figure out exactly what do we have to put in place there. So that's one part of the answer. The other thing that I didn't really touch on yet is we are actually prospectively trying to change the way that data is collected for research purposes to make it such that even genetic information can be shared broadly for research purposes. So these consent forms that people sign when they go into a clinical trial are not designed to provide the best way to cure a disease. They're designed to cover the pharmaceutical company's butt in case of a lawsuit, right? So you tend to have these really narrow consents that says, I give my data to company X, and they can use this data for research on disease Y under these conditions, and right, and then it's like hard to actually do something else innovative, even though that's probably what the patient wants you to do, right, is put the data into the public domain. So we were working with John Wilbanks of Creative Commons to develop a what we call portable legal framework or something, or legal consents. So we're trying to build clauses that we can get patients to demand to be dropped into clinical trial languages that says, if you're collecting my data and I'm a terminal cancer patient, I actually require you, in, if you're gonna use me to do your study, you have to take this data and you have to make it available to the public research community, because as a patient, that's actually what I want. I want the most number of people working on this data in as many different ways as possible, right? So one way is to try to, you have to build the legal framework, which we're doing, and then you have to go to the patient advocacy groups and get a critical mass of people to drop that in. And then there's a second framework that we're also doing in parallel, which is, don't even worry about that. Go directly to consumers and say, well, you just paid 23andMe to generate your SNPs, and now 23andMe owns your data, but nobody else can use it for research purposes. Go to 23andMe, ask for your SNPs back, sign our consent form, drop it in here. We'll build a cohort of people that have given us their 23andMe data, and we'll make it available for any researcher to do anything they want with it. We're actually trying to do that as well. So there's clinical trials that have already happened and have already been consented, it's pretty much impossible to go back and change the terms of consent. And we have to understand those terms of consent and then try to do our best to, as broadly as possible, serve the patient's interest by making data available for research purposes, but still, comply with the terms of consent as they were written, despite, what we think about how valid those are. And then, there's the kind of prospective thing. But the prospective stuff, that is 5 to 10 years minimum to actually start changing the way that people can work with data. Other questions?
So, coming from this from a very different angle, which is having this public population-based data available back to the patients for their daily, everyday health management. I don't know how much it's going to be feasible, and I'm guessing your answer will be no. But my question is, right now, when you say this data is available to the public, that public is basically researchers.
Yes.
Yes. I'm wondering how much you're aware of this work or any kind of possibility in getting this data available for patients and having some kind of filtering interface in the middle that can help patients understand this data better and utilize it for their...
Yeah, so we're aware of the problem. I think that's one of the areas that is handling that ourselves is kind of outside the scope of what Sage can do, because we've been through several cases where we want to partner with maybe a hospital or some other organization, and really it should be the case that the easily identifiable patient data should be stripped out of these things, no matter what, right? There's no reason to include address and telephone number in a data set that you're giving to the researchers to do this sort of work on. So really, it needs to be the case that the patient, the hospitals, and the people that are collecting the data need to have a map of the patient identifier that's used in the research data to the real person's identity, and then the hospital and the actual institution that's providing care to the patient needs to be the one to interface with the patient and say, kind of follow the research and then say, well, based on the results of this new research program, we think that we need to shift your therapy for your cancer in this way, right? But that's not something that Sage is going to try to do directly, but it's something that our partners need to do. But the partners need to hold that map of patient identity to, right? And even if it's possible to get the patient identity out of research data, we're telling all the researchers that get our data, don't do that, right? Don't try to identify on individuals in the study. Don't contact individuals directly if you have a research finding. You have to go back to, the care to the patient needs to funnel back through the to the organizations that know how to deal with patients.
Just us more talking about patients' direct access to data, and they will work as civil scientists.
Yeah, I mean, there's some talk about that, but I mean, I really don't know how many patients or citizen scientists are going to do leading edge statistical modeling of on this type of data. I mean, it sounds great in theory, but I'm a little bit skeptical whether that's. I mean, we're trying to involve patients, but patients can be involved by influencing funding decisions, making it so that researchers get rewarded more for making progress on a disease rather than getting a Nature paper out that doesn't actually do anything up but get that researcher more funding. Patients can be involved in getting their samples and their data into the research project and kind of monitoring at a high level the results of research. But if it actually gets into, is somebody going to wake up with, a terminal form of cancer and then cure their own disease? I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical of whether that's really feasible.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank the speaker.
Okay.
Great, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah, almost.
It's fun. This is a good group. We watch it.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
I'm really interested in this sort of work to help file and share their reports.
Yes. So we have a couple different ways that we can connect you. One is I do software engineering internships that are very much focusing on actually writing code.
And how much background would you require? I wrote code a long time ago, and I remember parts of it, but I would say I'm very skilled right now. I'm out of practice.
Right. That's what I don't necessarily require a lot, but it's
John.
Also a matter of matching the internship to your career goals, right?
So the HEMA program
I have taken undergrads that are pretty raw.
The HEMA program,
relatively low skills, but that's on their career path.
I mean, they've been around for a long time.
A better match for you might be some sort of internship on
managers, medical record administrators to go back to.
And it's a master's program in health services. Very analytical.
Well, yeah, they have a master's program, so I understand that
they've been
working
other projects that
as part of the BHI
where
program.
You're doing analysis, you have
Gretchen Murphy
a little bit of code to do it, but it's not contributing to the.
Yes, I think I know what you're referring to now.
There
was a group in public health that proposed a master's degree.
Yeah, I really want it.
And that was shot down.
I want to get back to practice.
It was shot down. Why?
Because there's a CPCT program.
Yeah, so why don't you.
There's already a program run out of nursing and now the School of Medicine as well. There is a master's program in the School of Medicine that is duplicative, that is for clinicians. And for health administrators.
That was fine, but they're if you're looking summer, then.
CIPCT.
CIPCT. I think I've seen
there's no rush.
Right. So
the other question is, would you consider
out of nursing and out of
something longer than the summer?
And MBHI.
Maybe summer and
so fall. You say that the.
Shut down.
So
about 6 months ago or 4 months ago.
Two quarters.
They've been working on it. They're active nationally.
There's enough of a ramp up where
all of that.
Typically, you get a lot more out of it if you invest a little time.
You can't have two master's programs on the same campus.
Maybe it's summer or part-time.
But
either seems
to make it a different niche.
There needs to be some way to bring those folks together because they're the ones that actually run the data capture mechanism in healthcare. Yeah.
No, I prefer 2-1.
Okay,
actually.
Healthcare information.
So would you just think spring, summer, or
certified people are the people who capture the data and get it abstracted and sent to the billers. And the billers, do the wallet biopsy, everything else. Healthcare.
So
get the goddamn money. And
maybe with
the
ACD, maybe.
Problem for 20 years.
Maybe get 3 calls if those are.
Glenn Cobb was the one that told me 40 years ago.
I'll pause the priority to call them.
It's still the problem.
But, okay.
They've been trying to do that. I did want to catch him here, but.
Show me, I'll be up in a few minutes.
Yeah. Hang
on. But, yeah.
Anyway, I'll leave you looking at. There's a curious what really fits heavy at all.
No.
Is that a correction considered? Yeah, I mean, if you thought about providing
Yes, I have. But we just haven't had, frankly, I haven't had the bandwidth to do anything along those lines yet. I think there are probably a number of external tools that you could take and pull into the environment to help with data visualization and kind of provide that richer environment. And kind of a related thing is that a lot of the early users have been asking for is a way to publish things like the environment like R,